the ideas, the leaders, the lives that are shaping Denmark and the world. From Blocks Hub in Copenhagen, Denmark, with your co-hosts, Ed Lay and Thomas Mulhern, this is Global Denmark.
Hello, and welcome back to the Global Denmark podcast, where we explore how thought leaders and innovators are working to create a better Denmark and a better world. We recently had the pleasure of sitting down with Gerrit Tinggaard Svendsen. Svendsen is a professor of public policy at the University of Aarhus, has a PhD in economics, and is, as we like to call him, the guru of trust. Having authored the book on trust and explored the topic in detail, we thought he is the perfect guy to have on, as this is a topic that comes up again and again on our podcast. In this wide-ranging conversation, we take a deep dive into trust, looking at its historical implications in Denmark, how it manifests itself in the society in the 1800s, what it's like now, the impact on the economy, and how we can leverage it moving forward. Without further ado, we bring you Professor Gerrit Tinggaard Svendsen.
We are back. I am here, as always, with my co-host, Mr. Ed Lay. Ed, how are you?
I'm good. I mean, I preferred the edited out introduction, but I'll take this one. Looking forward to getting started.
That will never be heard. And our special guest today, the guru of trust himself, Professor Gerrit. How do I pronounce your last name?
Tinggaard Svendsen. Okay. These are very hard names to pronounce, and it reminds me of the American actor Danny Kaye. When he was here in Copenhagen, recall the movie called Wonderful Copenhagen. He was asked about the Danish language, and he said that this is not a language, this is a throat disease.
Wow, it's nice for someone to finally put words to what I've been experiencing. Fantastic. Well, I want to dive right in. We hear about other countries, China, Brazil, quote-unquote, getting to Denmark to study the Danish model on trust. Yeah. Can you break that down for us and why these larger countries are looking to Denmark?
Yeah, it's amazing. Denmark is a big puzzle to the rest of the world. So we have this saying, which was coined in the World Bank, getting to Denmark. And what makes other countries wonder is that Denmark is rich and happy. At the same time, we have the lowest level of corruption in the world, and last but not least, the highest level of trust. So that's what makes people wonder, and they want to understand what is going on. And then you might try to copy some of the elements that you would like to have in your own country.
So maybe you could break it down for us. Why is Denmark number one? Yep. They are number one, correct, in trust in the world?
That's a very good question, and why it is so. We can observe it is so, but the explanation why it is so probably has deep historical roots, finding out why it is so, and we have to study history. We have to be aware of the high level of trust and wonder about it, because when you live in Denmark, as a Dane, you don't think about it. It's just there, and it's been there for your whole life, and it does not make you wonder, but when you go abroad, then you start wondering. And the way I discovered Denmark myself was when I was studying in the United States at Maryland University. My supervisor, Mansur Olson, the first question was, why are you doing so well in Denmark? Why are you rich and happy? And that put me on the track. And when I came back home, I started studying it and also started studying history. And if you look at Danish history, what characterizes it is that historically, a lot of trade has been going on. So we are really a trading nation. It's a nation of shopkeepers. In fact, the name Copenhagen, København, means købmandshavn. So it's the harbor of the traders. Mm. It's just, again, a way of putting that we are doing a lot of trade. And one of the big companies is Maersk. Maersk Company is a trading company. And historically, we've traded a lot. and we traded long distance trade. So that's the first mark in history where people meet and you start meeting strangers, and you have to do a transaction, you have to do a deal, do a trade. Early in Danish history, actually, we cannot read and write. We are analphabets. So when we trade, we have to trade based on a word. So a word is a word becomes a strong social norm in Denmark very early on.
So it was pragmatic, too, that the written contract wasn't possible.
Right. I think we've been lucky that the written contract was not possible. We had to cope without written contracts. And therefore, social control becomes very, very important, that if somebody cheats you, you have to punish the cheater in this market or in this trading center, wherever you are. If somebody cheats you and the cheater shows up, you can tell the cheater that this is not good, and also you can tell other people about it. So this cheater will get a bad branding, a bad reputation. And this, in fact, disciplines people a lot. It's a way of bringing up people and teaching them how we do things here, what is the norm, the non-written rule of the game here.
So both Britain and Holland have both been big trading towns. Was there towns? Countries. Was there a big drawback that they could write contracts?
Right. I guess they were much better at writing contracts, but again, also there would have been a very beneficial effect from the trade activity and meeting other people. That would be something that would add and accumulate even more trust in both England and the Netherlands. What's more to it is then that if you look at Danish history, we get even more meeting places, not just trade, but we get also a lot of voluntary associations. And it starts especially around 1850. We get a whole lot of them, and we get the whole Grundtvig idea that people should meet and have dialogues, talk about things and how to solve problems. We get the whole dairy movement, we get these folk high schools, and a lot of meeting places. Danes are very, very fond of meeting and forming associations. So
these were common citizens, not just the aristocrats.
Yeah, the common citizens. There's a saying in Denmark that if two Danes meet, they shake hands. If three Danes meet, they form an association. So that's how it is. It's unbelievable.
Three is the golden number.
So it means, so I don't know if any of you, are you doing something in your leisure time, in a voluntary...
Leisure time.
Are you doing something in a sports club, or you have some leisure time left, I guess? Or?
Well, with a toddler, it's been tough. But I do, yes.
What do you do?
Well, I play golf.
You play golf.
Yeah.
So say now that you sell one of your old golf clubs to another person in the golf club, and he would like just to try it first before buying it and see if it works okay. And then he promised to pay... on mobile pay, whenever. But he forgets to pay. He keeps the equipment, but he forgets to pay for it. And then you see what happens. Well, the next time he shows up, you ask about how things are running and if he's doing well, and you haven't received the money yet. And he apologizes perhaps, but again, nothing happens. And eventually this person has to decide whether to pay or deliver back the equipment, or find another golf club. Otherwise, it's not fun playing golf any longer in that club where he's cheated somebody like you.
Yeah.
So in this way, this person is brought up and is taught how the non-written rule of the game, how the norm is in this country and in this golf club. So what is crucial here is that most people in the golf club thinks that you're the hero. You're the hero because you trusted the other person.
Yeah.
Whereas in some other countries, the hero could be the one who cheats, because this person got a good without paying for it.
So this was just a core value or principle from the beginning of Denmark's history, that we want to be the hero that trusts, not the hero that that wins at all costs.
That's a very strong norm early on. So that's the first theory here, that it's been probably developed bottom-up, this norm for cooperation, because it's about creating win-win situations. So we have been lucky to get into a path in Danish history where we discovered something that works. In this case, you can trade golf equipment without writing things down. You don't need a lawyer, you don't need a thick written contract, whatever. You can do a transaction, a deal, a trade, fast and easy. And this just makes it much easier to do trades, and it creates more win-win situations, because the one you trade with, the one you sell to, will rather have the equipment than the money, and you'd rather have the money than the equipment. Yeah. And in this way, both parties gain from the transaction, from the trade. And that's good. The more win-win situations you can get in society, the richer and more happy we become. What has been measured too is that when you do these trades based on a word, a hormone called oxytocin is released in your body. It's also called the love hormone, and it makes you happy. It's also released when you sing, when you dance, when you hold a baby and look it into the eyes, when you hug people. Actually, it's released when tribes do these activities. It's actually many of the tribal activities that can be observed that release oxytocin.
And it's released when you see that the person that you've trusted earns that trust?
Exactly. So that's exactly the key word in trust, is exactly that you can earn it and that you live up to the expectation. So the key word in trust is expectation. And when you're not disappointed, when the other one cooperates as promised, then you become very happy. Then this happiness hormone is released in your body, and you feel good. And you may ask, do we have more golf equipment for sale?
Yeah. You know? More of this oxytocin, please.
Yeah, and even more oxytocin is released, and you have a good time. And I know you early on discussed happiness and hygge, and I think that oxytocin is an important story of hygge.
So do you think that a prerequisite for this oxytocin exchange, this trust exchange, is face-to-face? So the further... You mentioned before we started recording that Denmark are actually heading towards the rest of the world, and is that a side effect of digitization?
I think that that it's very important that we have this face-to-face interaction in daily life, because then we can recognize each other, we can recognize each other's faces, and we can reward each other socially. So when you do the right thing, you say thanks a lot for the golf equipment and it's a pleasure using it, and the other one can say thanks for the money, buy something else then or whatever, and that you reward each other socially. So in this way, we just keep in mind what is good behavior. And then if somebody cheats, then they should be teased a little bit, or they should be reminded that this is not good behavior. That's important to support what is good behavior. So therefore, it's very important that we stay in this path and not jump into another path, for example, all of a sudden. And one big risk here is that we start controlling more, that we start moving away from the trust society where we are now, where the Danes are the most trusting people in the world. If we start moving into another path, into the controlled path, and moving into controlled society, then all of a sudden we start using a lot of resources to control people and make sure that they don't cheat. And why should you use a lot of resources to control people that you can trust, basically? That's
so those are the kind of the economics of it. So by the more amount of trust you have, the less you can cut down on the transactional costs.
Exactly. That's exactly the point. So it's all about saving transaction costs, both in the public sector, in the everyday life, and also in the private sector. So both private and public business should do anything to use as much trust as possible in their activities, because in this way they become more competitive and they can use resources for other things than controlling people.
You mentioned before that one of the big developments in Danish history that cultivated this trust phenomenon was these meeting places, whether it was the dairy movement or the Endes Boli and... or different movements you talked about. What I hear a lot is that when we talk about people from the outside coming in now, global talent, that they feel a lot of times excluded from being part of these meeting places where trust is cultivated.
Yeah.
Whether it's a sports association, a friendship group, And I'm wondering, how can trust be afforded to outsiders coming into a more closed-off game?
That's a good question, and it's not easy to come to Denmark because we have all these non-written rules of the game. We have a lot of norms that have not been written down, and it's just there. We have this long history where we're used to do things in a certain way. So we have a lot of tacit knowledge, and so really, how to get into touch with the Danes when you arrive? My recommendation would be to start in a voluntary organization somewhere, start singing in a choir, go to sports, meet the Danes in their leisure time, and in this way you start getting a sense of how things work out. And
so you see actually these as key venues to really build that trust.
That's a key venue, and in this way you get into the social networks which are strong. So sometimes you also call it social capital, which means that you have different types of networks, and these networks can actually be exclusive sometimes. Bonding is also called. So then it's very hard to get into them, and at other times they are more open and bridging networks, social networks, and these open bridging social networks, you experience them often in these voluntary organizations where you have very open-minded people, and you get into touch with them. And what often happens is also you can ask for advice. You can ask, do you know of a good place to live, for example, or do you know if how to get a job? And that's often a very, very good way of entering.
It's amazing you made the point about this kind of tacit knowledge or these implicit society rules that aren't written down. I was hired by a Danish private school to run their international side. And one of the things we saw a lot was you had all these international families coming in, and teachers as well, and people were very, very confused what the rules were. And they said, where can I find this? And then all the Danish colleagues were saying, well, we just know. And then you realize at that point, okay, we need to make the implicit explicit for people who aren't familiar with the rules of the game. And I think that's where we run into a lot of problems, is that if people don't know the rules of the game, because they weren't brought up playing this game, Danish game,
exactly,
you need to be able to be mindful of the implicit rules and make them explicit.
Exactly. It's exactly about the implicit or non-written rules of the game. That's exactly what we're talking about here. And one of these rules is, of course, trust, because now we talk about trust being built bottom-up when people meet in trading centers, or when they meet in voluntary associations, or when they meet in sports halls, or wherever they meet. Another important explanation when you look at Danish history, which we have to mention too, is a top-down approach. And what happens, luckily, in Danish history is that we start fighting corruption very early on. So already back in 1660, a Danish king, Frederick III, he starts fighting corruption. And the reason is that we've just been beaten by the Swedes in war. And the Swedes have taken the southern part of Sweden, and they're just on the other side of Öresund. And they're they're very close to coming.
They walked across the ice?
Yeah, and they're very close to, they can actually take Denmark, the whole of Denmark, and they have the chance, and it's very high-risk situation. So to collect money for the state, you need to get rid of corruption. Because when you have a corrupt country, it's very hard to collect taxes. People don't like paying taxes because they know money disappears. At the same time, all the tax collectors and whatever, they steal money, and nothing is left for the state to invest in military or roads, bridges or navy. So what he does is that he starts getting rid of the nobility. They had all the high positions before, and he gets rid of them. They were lazy and quite useless and corrupt. That was the big problem. And he starts hiring people that are supposed to be non-corrupt, and then get into a very positive path where also the later kings, they follow in this path and keep on fighting corruption. And again, this means more predictability in society, so you can better expect what people are doing. It means, for example, that if you're cheated in now you keep on selling golf equipment, mm-hmm. And now you sell a lot, and then somebody cheats you, and it's obvious that this other trading partner has cheated you. There's no doubt about it. You have to take this part this person into court, and then it's very nice if the right one wins the court case. That the judge is not corrupt or the police is corrupt. Because if they are corrupt, you cannot predict what would be the outcome of the court case. Mm-hmm. And that's highly problematic in a society, because if you cannot trust the court system or the police, the bureaucrats or the politicians, then it's very hard to predict what is going on and how to make a career, for example, for young people, or what can they do to climb the ladder if they have talent. How can you do business and so on? And this is extremely harmful for trust, because it's very hard to predict what will happen. And in this way, you cannot trust other people. You have to make sure that you are not cheated. Yeah.
You mentioned making the implicit rules explicit. What are the implicit rules? I mean, if I want to, you mentioned trust, of course. If I want to get trust, if I want to gain trust, I need to give that away. But how do I find opportunities to give away trust?
Yeah, by reciprocating. I think that's, if you take the trust issue here, so what's very important is that you keep reciprocating. But like, if you look at the Danes, they're typically called blue-eyed or naive. I mean, so they tend to cooperate the first time you meet them. And so that's kind of the starting point. That's very important, because then it's easier to start cooperating and creating a win-win situation when you have two persons that don't want to cheat each other at first sight. But if somebody cheats you, then the next time, in the next game, the next play, then you will not cooperate with the cheater. Then you punish the cheater by defecting, by not wanting to cooperate in the next game with the cheater. So if the cheater comes again and wants to buy more golf equipment and hasn't paid for the first delivery, then
you're going to have to put money down first.
Have to put money down first, and you have to behave yourself, and you punish, and perhaps you also, again, tell other people about what happened. So, and on the other hand, if this person cooperated, then you reward the person by cooperating in the next game. And this is reciprocal behavior. This is very important. But we have all these kind of things. For example, fairness is another example. So it means that if we say now that the municipality of Copenhagen, they want to do an experiment here in the studio, and they've given us a 100 kroner note, and now we're going to share this 100 kroner note between us. Now I'm going to offer you an amount of this 100 kroner note, and then you have to say yes or no to my offer.
The prisoner's dilemma.
So, and then your expectation will probably be that we should split 50-50, because that's how it is. And say that the rules there are so that if you say yes, then we'll split as I suggest. But if you say no, nobody will get any money. Then the 100 kroner just disappears in Øresund. So if I suggest to you we split it 50-50, you probably say yes. And we split and we create a win-win situation. We both earn money. If I suggest, say, 10 kroner and then I'll keep the 90, you'll probably say no, because it's not fair.
Despite the fact that I win.
Despite the fact that you still win 10 kroner.
Yeah.
But it's just not fair. And I don't understand the rules of the game here, because it should be around 50-50.
That varies upon country, though, does it not?
It can vary. But in Denmark, you have to stick around the 50 to make sure that you can make a deal. You see, in this way, you can punish me by saying no to the 10 kroner. Actually, it costs you 10 kroner to say no. But you might do it to make sure that I don't get the 90 to bring me up and teach me how the non-written rule of the game is here, that we split around 50-50, half-half. And you see, this is quite wild, because normally if you are just a strict homo economicus without any moral, without any social norms, then you should just take the money, because some money is better than nothing. So these kind of rules, they're all over. They're all over the place. Also, how you behave in a football match, for example, and before and after and during the match, and we have all these kinds of things going on.
Now, do you think that trust, when there's a Dane interacting with a non-Dane, is the trust level the same at the starting point as it would be for a Dane and a Dane? And if is this conscious or an unconscious bias?
I think typically that the Danes were, typically meet our open mind and trust in general other people. We have, and I think early on you actually mentioned this digitalization process, and also, I guess, the whole internet phenomenon here, because what actually happens quite often now in Denmark is that Danes get cheated on the web, that get into some kind of relationship, or some people tell them you have to transfer money, or they can sort of hack the IT systems and get in there, and somehow they pretend to be a leader, a director that asks for money, somebody else for money,
yeah.
And then they just do it, the Danes, because they're used to do these kind of things just and cooperate. And actually, there's been some cheating, but again, you cannot see the other person, and you don't have this face-to-face interaction, which is very strong tradition also in Denmark.
I imagine that's where language comes into play too, because you want to get maximized trust, you want the face-to-face relation, and the oral contract is conditional upon oral communication.
Right.
So if you're speaking Danish,
right,
it probably boosts that effect,
right,
and thereby gives you more trust.
That's a good point, yeah. You can relate to the whole welfare state of Denmark trust issue here, because again, you need to run this kind of welfare state, this universal welfare state that we have, you need trust. So first you need to trust that most people contribute somehow, most people pay taxes, or they do voluntary work, or they do something. It doesn't matter what you're doing, just as long as you're doing something. So the work ethic is very, very high in Denmark. So you're supposed to do something, because any job is good. It doesn't matter what it is, just you do something, and it can be voluntary work as well. And then the second condition is also that when you pay taxes to the welfare state, or the bumblebee, as we also call it, it's a bumblebee because it's very heavy, but all this it needs a lot of tax money to be financed so that it can fly.
God knows how it can fly.
And all these social
is
benefits. But the second thing to keep the bumblebee flying is that the politicians, the bureaucrats, when they collect taxes, that they invest these tax money in a way so that we get more back than we pay in taxes. And so we trust that they're not corrupt, and that they don't steal the money, basically, and that they do their job well.
I can see how it's all intertwined.
Would it be fair to say that in Danish politics of late, that some of the politicians have been suggesting that they can pull off things that they actually can't?
Well, there have been some scandals lately, also in the bureaucracy, and we are very much aware of corruption problems, any kind of corruption problems in Denmark. And as I mentioned earlier on, it's a tradition dating back to 1660, so it's very, very strong. So we have this kind of Max Weber ideal for the perfect bureaucracy. We had it actually before Max Weber in Denmark, and it's very, very strong. And that leads me to the second. So this second main condition, we have the bottom-up approach, where people on their own start organizing and regulating themselves and cooperating based on trust. But then the top-down approach about fighting corruption, it holds today. It's very, very crucial that whenever there's a scandal or a problem, like the one in the Danish Ministry of Social Affairs, there was a scandal recently where there was embezzlement, a big embezzlement problem. And these kind of things, bribes or embezzlements, we have to make sure it doesn't happen again. Because basically we are small statisticians, so we count every day what happens, really. So it means that
Us as individuals, do you mean?
As individuals. We count, for example, I don't know, if you use your bike to work here, you go by bike.
Yeah.
So it's based on statistics. So say that you were attacked every second time you were riding your bike to here, you'd probably consider stop biking because you cannot no longer trust.
I'd give that some thought, yeah. Yeah. Probably wouldn't even take that many.
But I mean, you're in the public sphere and you're vulnerable, you know. You're vulnerable and you might be attacked if there are gangs and so on. And in my small book, Trust, here, I write, in the beginning, I write about how it is to come directly from a holiday on Læsø, on the island of Læsø, where it's very peaceful and a lot of hygge and a lot of trust, and go directly to Durban, second largest city in South Africa. And here you could not, it was very hard to move around in the public sphere or public space because there was a risk of being attacked and mocked. So it's based on experience. And the same thing for scandals, and how the public authorities, how they handle it. Are they in control? So if there's a big corruption scandal, then it's very important that it only happens once and that it's been taken care of. If it happens every week and it repeats happening, then we have a problem. And that will count in people's statistics, the way they perceive the state and the way they perceive other people. And then they might start thinking, perhaps trust no longer matters. It doesn't work any longer. We have to move into a new path.
Yeah, and that, as we've seen in recent studies, has a profound effect on the GDP and the bottom line for companies. I read a study where in the last 15 years, Denmark's level of trust has gone from 78 to 61%, which is still extremely high on the, I don't know if it's number one still, but it may be.
Mm-hmm.
But for each percentage point of trust reduction, it was equivalent to 1 billion Danish crowns in lost GDP revenue.
It's so much money we're talking about here. It reminds me of, I was lucky to sit next to a former director of a big Danish company called ISS.
Yeah.
And I've just given a talk, and I was sitting next to this director during the meal afterwards, and then he said to me, Gert, what you just talked about is exactly what we did in ISS. So we were about 20 persons sitting here in Copenhagen, and then we delegated power to regional leaders all over the world, and we knew well that somebody, sometimes we were cheated and somebody might cheat us now and then, but the cost of controlling all these people would be much, much higher than the cost of being cheated. So actually it paid us well to trust people in general all around the world to lower our cost, lower our transaction costs in the company, earn higher profits, and in this way we could outcompete the big American companies. Mm. Because typically, the American companies they were up against, they had a lot of people controlling the employees, which was extremely costly for them. Often they also had more sick days and so on because people did not feel at ease at work often because there was a lot of control. Mm. That was basically the explanation of ISS's big success worldwide.
The counter argument is, if I get cheated, won't then I just let it go? Won't they continue to do it again?
Yeah, so if you're cheated and you know who the cheater is, so then, of course, then you have to... So if you have a company and you notice have an employee here who didn't do the work in the right way and so on, you have to call this employee in, of course, and talk to the person and explain how you normally do things here and what you expect from this person. From doing that to start controlling all people in the firm. So it could be, for example, people that assist, a home care assistant, for example. That's what we call it in English, a home care
assistant.
Yeah, home care assistant.
My English is deteriorating, by the way. I'm not the right one to ask.
So, for example, in Denmark, we have a home care assistant that doesn't do the work properly. And, of course, you have to talk to this home care assistant. But from there and then to start controlling all home care assistants all over Denmark is a big jump because most of the home care assistants, there are no problems at all, and you can trust them. So therefore, you can let them do their job, and they'll find out how to do that.
So you don't control, but you measure output.
You measure output, exactly. It's enough to measure output. That's exactly the idea.
Isn't this whole discussion fundamentally about safety and predictability, in a way? I mean, from a psychological perspective, we're talking about if you cannot predict the outcome of something,
right,
you try to control the chaos.
Right.
I mean, that's, in any facet of life.
That's exactly the point, that you can predict behavior. One way of handling this risk of being chilled, or for example being attacked in open street, is looking at tourists in Denmark. And we've also done a study where we can see that the most important reason for choosing Denmark as tourist destination is safety. So it's that you can walk the streets safely, your kids are safe, they can play on the beach, and they can move around safely. And that's due to the high level of trust. And if you're in trouble, you can ask somebody and they'll help you, assist you in coping with a problem.
So yeah, and that eventually leads to, you know, babies out in their prams unattended.
That eventually
without even blinking an eye.
You take that back to England and people start yelling at you actively. Although I lost some trust for Denmark when I finally saw The Little Mermaid and realised just how little. You saw that, like, this was oversold.
But exactly, you have these baby prams outside, not only in the summer, but also in the winter time, and they're not kidnapped.
I can see how it's difficult then, too. That it's easier to contain trust and predictability in a smaller setting. So if you open up for global talent, or you keep scaling outside of the 5.5 million, it becomes more and more unpredictable.
But again, we have still the baby prams outside, and we still have
the rules.
And we still have the self-managed.
Internally in Denmark, but if you're in a globalized economy.
Well, yeah, but I guess you adapt. So if you come from a, say, low-trust society to a high-trust society, I guess you adapt eventually, because it pays better to cooperate and create win-win situations.
Are there any countries that have leapt up in trust?
Are
there any countries in the world that have leapt up in the trust?
They leapt up in trust, yeah. I think the Scandinavian countries have gradually leapt up over time. Since 1980, we gradually got more and more trust. Whereas United States, for example, have
that was because of increased density, therefore increased trade, are there any countries that have leapt up in any other ways?
How do we give a country advice?
At the country,
right.
You want to increase your trade,
what,
or your trust?
Is a better question. Thank you. I'm glad we're trusting.
That's exactly. And what we can see is that in general, that people, countries that have been successful in fighting corruption, have generally climbed up the trust ladder as well, because again you get more predictability in society and more clear rules of the game. How do you manage here? You have these low trust countries, like for example Brazil is a low ranking country, and reminds me when I was in Rio de Janeiro, I was in a hotel, and on the other side of the street there was a small vegetable store. And outside this small vegetable store, there were two doors, two entrances, and one on each side to the vegetable store. And at each entrance, there was a guard. There was a fully armed guard with a machine gun and tough-looking people. And then you have to put the price of these guards. You have to pay them a wage, and you have to pay them equipment and so on. And you have to put these costs on top of the price on the vegetables. So it becomes very, very costly.
Right.
And you need a lot of security, and also have observed a lot of guards in the streets and so on. And society becomes very, you know, it's very slow working and troublesome to maneuver in this society. And then a couple of years ago,
an infrastructure around distrust.
Yeah, but I mean, you bind so much the resources in controlling, in making life safe, as you talked about before, in safety. And the fun thing is that I had a Brazilian student a couple of years ago, and she told me that she felt very unsafe when she came to Denmark because there were no guards around. She was looking for gods, but there were no one.
Right.
And but then we save all the gods.
You know, I see that actually, not with the guards, but the psychology of it. When I ran in international schools, I mentioned the expatriate children, when they're put into the Danish pedagogical framework, where it was a lot more free and no guards, they felt out of balance and weren't sure how to navigate in it. And to some degree, probably if you sat down and spoke to them, which I did at some point, a little bit unsafe because they weren't given the frame that they were used to.
Exactly. They're completely another frame. And some years ago, I think it was back in 97 or something, there was a Danish mother in New York City. I remember her. She placed her pram with the baby outside a cafe in New York. And another person in
she
the cafe called the police.
Time.
Sorry?
She's still in jail.
Yeah, she went to jail. She was arrested. And she couldn't convince the judge and the American authorities that this is legal in Denmark.
Yeah.
They wouldn't believe her.
Why? What would you say to people that suggested that would suggest that the last recession and maybe the next one are caused by placing trust in the wrong place?
Right, that's a good discussion. Actually, I have written a few pieces about the last financial crisis, where actually I argue that high trust countries are more calm, so they don't panic as much as low trust countries, because they think that it'll work out somehow.
Does that come down to individuals as well? Do low trust individuals panic more than high trust individuals?
So they'll tend not to trust that. They'll think that all other people will run to the bank and get their monies, and they'll do the same, and they perhaps don't even trust the bank that much, and they just want the money back and hide it under the bed or something.
Yeah, I saw that in the last recession, that a lot of foreign investors were looking at the Danish real estate market because of its low corruption and predictability and these things. So, and exactly to your point.
That's how it is. And
you're so dependent upon maybe the Chinese or American economies because of the nature of capitalism.
That's true.
It has a trickle-down effect.
That's true, and there's a whole discussion here also, how much should you bail out the financial sector here? Should it be up to the market to choose the winners, or should the state start subsidizing and helping and bailing out banks and financial sector in general? That's a big discussion. Talking about trust again here and the welfare state, it's very important that in the future that we try to stick to what we are good at, so we don't start trying to do things that we're bad at, because then we start losing competitiveness both in the public and in the private sector.
And trust is one of those, right? Kent Jensen said trust is the Danish competitive advantage.
It is. I also call trust the Danish gold, or the Danish X factor, or the special Danish feature. And I think a good comparison here is also in sports. So actually we've done some pieces on football teams. So we have looked on football teams that have very low budgets. Some of them are actually doing better than football teams with very high budgets. And if you ask the low budget teams, why are you doing so well? They all say it's all about trust. We trust each other on the field, and we fight for each other. And also we trust the coach, and the coach trusts us. So it's all the way. And a typical training session here could be that, for example, one of these almost amateur football clubs that are doing very well in a professional tournament, that perhaps they played bad in a weekend. That's a good measure. If they've done bad in a match, which happens now and then, of course, what happens at the next training session? And then the trust manager, the trust coach, will then take them for a run together, and then he'll buy them an ice cream, for example, and then they'll talk about what went wrong, rather than punish them. So he'll reward them with an ice cream, and they talk what can they do better the next time, and learn from their mistakes.
Yeah.
So they're not afraid of doing mistakes when they play football.
Yeah.
And that's a crucial thing, both in a football team, but also in any business, both private and business and public sector, that you dare to make decisions and innovate, and you're not punished for making mistakes, but rather you might be rewarded because you tried, and okay, we can learn from your mistake.
I mean, it almost sounds like in the future that businesses should have a chief trust officer.
A chief trust officer.
If it has such a profound impact.
That's a good idea. Your point is taken.
CTO is already taken, isn't it?
Oh, we'll have to rebrand it.
So, as a country, how do we double down on trust? How do we further increase Denmark's competitive advantage?
Right. So the first thing is that we have to be aware of trust. We have to be aware it's there, and then we have to maintain it, as you say, and then use it actively. So I think that the big thing here is that we should start using it more actively. So rather than thinking about how can we control things, how can we make sure that errors do not happen, and spend a lot of resources doing these things, then we should start actively thinking about how to use trust, because when we use it, we maintain it at the same time. And our discussions here today point to meeting places as one main thing. So it means, for example, if you have an organization, so we have a leadership, and then you have different levels perhaps in this organization and for different types of employees, it's crucial that you meet across these levels so that you don't have isolated levels where you don't meet levels, lower levels, that you have actually meeting places. And then you can discuss what's happening in the firm and what can you do better, and you might get very, very good ideas. You can harvest good ideas from people on the floor. They say that perhaps we should try and do this and that. Okay, let's try that, and we'll see if it works. It might work out, it might not, but we can try it. And it's this way everybody will feel part of the whole firm, and good ideas are always welcome.
So open and inclusive meeting places with low power distance.
Yeah.
Got it.
Sharing our podcast as well will help.
It always helps.
Maybe reviewing.
Exactly. Well, I think we could probably go on all day, but I'm mindful of our time. So we're going to take a quick break and come back with the quick fire round to finish off the podcast today.
Studying for an executive MBA at Henley Business School in Denmark is an intense and rewarding experience. If you want to achieve the best possible outcomes in business and in life, we can give you the skills and knowledge you need through the Henley MBA. For more info, visit henley.dk.
Okay, we are back with our quick fire round. The questions will be quick fire. Your answers don't need to be. Do you have any habits or routines or daily practices that you do to keep yourself mentally or physically sharp?
I bike to work. I bike about 20 kilometers every day.
Road bike?
Yeah, both ways. Because based on statistics, it's very healthy to bike, and it's a cheap way, and it's just as fast, I think even faster than going by car in hours, in the morning and in the afternoon. And also, it's safe. So that's something I appreciate a lot, and at the same time, it's very beautiful nature that I bike through. So that I feel very lucky to be privileged and can do this activity every day. A second activity, I used to do a lot of sports, and now with family and work and everything, it's more fitness, work out. So I try to do that as regular as possible, and that's also, and then you can listen to jazz music or something at the same time. I think that's very nice too. And when you do physical activities, you think even better. I get a lot of ideas when I do physical workouts and so on. And I always have my notes, paper and pen with me, and can write down new ideas.
Have you ever undergone any one experience that fundamentally changed you?
I think the experience I mentioned earlier on, coming to the United States, Mansa Olsen posing me the question, why are you doing well? And I couldn't answer it. Why are you doing well in Denmark? And then I had to find out was something that basically caught my scientific interest and helped me all along. And it's sort of a rolling train since then. What do you say, rolling steamer or something?
The rest is history. Yeah.
Since then, I think I've really been fascinated by Denmark and Scandinavia and also other countries. And
Isn't that fascinating that you were awoken to this curiosity about Denmark while being abroad?
Exactly. So while you're in it, it's very hard to see what you're in. But then you have something to compare with, and you start wondering, what are we actually doing here?
We talk about that a lot, the kind of the benefits of just getting out of your default mode.
Right. You get out of your default mode. That's a good saying.
Do you have a mentor or a teacher growing up that you would credit with a change in direction or a or
I'll say,
like
as a, during my during my
well.
Yeah, I get your point. And during my political science studies, I was lucky to have a very clever professor, very skilled, Peter Nannister, who is still going strong actually at our university. He was my big mentor and has been ever since. And abroad, it has been especially Mansur Olson, was my supervisor at Maryland. Fantastic person, also very. So when you meet these people, you feel like doing something. You feel like working on. It's very inspiring. And another mentor is also Robert Putnam from Harvard University. He's been distinguished visiting professor at Harvard University. So he's one of the leading social scientists in the world, and he's real cool. And he likes Denmark and likes to study Denmark. And I think also he hopes to get the Nobel Prize eventually when he finds out why we have so much trust in Denmark.
You're not going to beat him
well,
to the punch.
Maybe you guys can get the award together up in Norway. I'm going to pivot a little bit. What's something weird about you, Garrett? Something weird that maybe you haven't shared in your book?
Something weird?
Yeah.
I guess I'm a little bit nerd, I would say. To get into something, I can think about one thing and keep on thinking about this thing and how to write about it and how to understand things.
Do you have an example of something really maybe other people don't study that much?
So I was just saying that I might be a bit absent-minded now and then, but I think I'm extremely open-minded to all sciences and something weird, you say.
Astrology.
You better ask my family. Or something. I like avant-garde jazz. I think that might be weird.
And when you say like, you mean you've studied it? And
yeah, then I also study the artists, and I also play music myself.
What do you play?
I play some guitar and some saxophone and a little bit of the flute. And so I'm singing a choir at the moment. And
okay.
I've been singing a choir for years,
one
actually.
One man band coming up here.
You're getting a lot of oxytocin now in the system, as you mentioned before.
That's exactly.
What's your biggest motivator and your biggest demotivator?
I think the motivator is biggest motivator is to understand the world around us and to be able to hopefully to communicate this understanding and actually make people happy. So I think what I try to do all the time is to make things as simple as possible, so it's easy to understand and communicate scientific results. And try to avoid all these strange scientific concepts, but try to talk in everyday language. So actually, it can be used for something in everyday life. And what makes me most happy, if people come to me and say, oh, I read one of your things, one of your pieces, or your book, or whatever, and it really meant something to me, and it changed my life, or it means that now at work I do this and that, and things like that really warms my heart and makes me feel like doing even more.
You're going to host a dinner party, and you can invite two people from history, alive or dead. Who would you want sitting next to you?
At a dinner party, and they can be dead also, or
yeah,
alive.
Well, at the party, they'll feel alive.
So on the left, Albert Einstein would be okay, because he was the one who, I think, first said that you should try to make or state things as simple as possible. And then on the other side, I'd like to have Mansur Olson, who was my supervisor, you know, and update him on the work and what I found out about Denmark and Scandinavia, because he died before I could tell him about our newest results. He first asked about the question, why are you doing so well, why are you rich and happy, and now I could give him the answer. We are rich and happy. The main explanation is that we are rich because we have high trust and thereby low transaction costs. And we're happy because when we do all these corporations and create these win-win situations. We produce oxytocin in our bodies, and that makes us happy at the same time.
Do you have any books that that you found most inspiring?
Yeah, then as Mansur Olson's book, Logic of Collective Action from 1965, here he basically invents the free rider concept, which means that you just try to maximize your profits whenever you can. So it means that if you are driving along a road and you see there's a self-manned stall along the road and there are strawberries, vegetables, whatever, and here the system is that you have to pay money in a cigar box, for example, and for what you take. So Mansur Olson will say that if the risk of detection is low, then you'll steal everything. And also the flag, if there's a Danish flag standing next to the cell phone stall, you'll steal as well. And just grab it and on you go. You just move on and sell it, or whatever you do. Whereas the other author I'll mention also is Elinor Ostrom. That would be my second recommendation for literature. So Elinor Ostrom wrote a famous book from 1990 called Governing the Commons. And she adds to this free rider or homo economicus theory that we are also, luckily, we are also human beings. We are social. We have social norms. And that's what we've been talking about today. So she adds trust, basically, on top of the economic incentives. So it means that when you pass this self-manned stall, you've been taught that you should not steal it all. You should pay for what you get. And you'll do it. And if you don't, you feel really bad about it. And you feel happy when you do it, because then you respect the norm, which is that you should pay for what you take. Then you get utility, extra utility, out of behaving correctly. Mm-hmm. It's an internal norm, or internalized norm in your body,
in
your brain.
Is it an internal norm or an internalized norm, in that if we never specifically raised a child with any sort of conditioning, would that child as an adult take that money?
I think you just be taught in general that you have to be honest, and you don't you're not supposed to cheat. And then you know that when you see this self-man stall, and if I just take the strawberries without paying for them, then I cheat.
Yeah, I was just wondering what the natural default would be.
Yeah. That's a good question.
But in nature, isn't it? There's what is nature? In the ecosystem.
Yeah.
Right.
That's a good point. We have a Danish author called Løgstrup, and he actually talks about that you're born with 100% trust. So you're not born as a cheater, you're born as a truster.
Yeah.
That's his argument. And then trust may eventually be destroyed as you grow older.
Yeah.
Well, it can be destroyed right when the gaze of the eyes aren't met.
Right.
Yeah. And that's proven in
things like that.
Romania, right?
Things like that, yeah. But I would recommend Elinor Ostrom's 1990 book, and basically she received the Nobel Prize for this book in 2009 as the first woman in economics and also the first political scientist, which was pretty cool.
Yeah,
excellent. Well, I'm mindful of our collective time here, and we're going to wrap up the podcast today with one final question, which we ask to all of our guests, and that is, what do you think you can teach Denmark through your work? And what do you think Denmark can teach the rest of the world?
Right. So I think the first thing I can teach is that we are very lucky. We have to appreciate our luck, that we historically end up in a path that works, where we have turned out rich and happy and low corruption. So this model, this Danish model, can then be exported. I think the main message to other countries is that trust and low corruption can be learned. Because if you have these two things, then you also become richer and more happy. So in a company, for example, you have to explain the employees that if we do things based on trust in this company, then it's easier for us to cooperate, and then we can all succeed together. We'll all be better off. We create win-win situations rather than we start fighting each other, or we work slow or have many sick days or whatever it is. That's important for both public and private firms. And for the public sectors, I think one main message is where to start: fight corruption. So whenever in the world you have corruption problems, start fighting corruptions. If you do that, there's a good chance that you start increasing social trust. At the same time, there will also be more room for more bottom-up activities of all kinds of things. Life becomes much easier for ordinary peoples in their ordinary lives. And that's a win-win situation for the whole world.
Geir Tinkor Svensson, it's been an absolute pleasure. Thank you so much for coming by the studio.
Thank you.
And
pleasure.
Before we go, is there anywhere where our audience can find you or your work?
Yeah, they can Google my name, of course, and look up my work there. And, and of course, I'd also recommend the small book on trust from Aarhus University Press, which hopefully in a simple way comes up with the things we've discussed today.
It does. I've read it. It's a great read. And we'll put it up on our website as well.
Thank you very much. I appreciate it.
And to our audience, don't forget to jump over to iTunes, Spotify, Stitcher, wherever you get your podcasts. Please help us continue to grow by rating, reviewing, subscribing. And until next time, see you on the GDP.
Are you getting the most out of your time in Denmark? Pick up your printed copy of the English language newspaper Copenhagen Post today to access relevant news and event information guaranteed to enhance your working and family life.